Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 27th of August, 15 minutes past 9 o'clock. Man, do we have a show for you, and we look forward to unfurling it over the next 3 hours and presenting it to you, and then you can make up your mind of whether you liked it or not. The music you just heard was House of Hamel playing the Parlor Room. How could this be any more civilized? In Northampton, Massachusetts, on Friday, the 6th of September, and you can go to parlorroom.org to hear more, to see more information about the event. But again, that's House of Hamel. We'll be playing our music going to into our breaks this morning. Let me introduce our group to you. I also welcome you to be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear what is on your mind. We welcome diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff. Good morning, Fred. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Doing fine. Drive up the thruway this morning was marked with dense fog, but I knew it would be worth the hassle.
That's right. Yeah. And as the fog lifts,
yes,
there in the lone ray of sunshine is WAMC.
Absolutely. Well said.
We go to political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, making her second consecutive appearance in a week. Thank you very much for
You're
being
welcome.
With us. We had an opening. I don't remember why, but thank you for filling it.
No
so
problem.
It's always good to have you here. And former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is with us. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. It's sunny finally out there and a beautiful day. It's been beautiful weather. We're blessed.
We are blessed. Also, along with blessings, we welcome Emma Edwards to the program. Emma is a senior at Wellesley. Perhaps you've heard of it. And she is Libby's intern for the summer. She's been with us a couple times this during the summertime and come in and is obviously working on a lot of this stuff with Libby and it's really good to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Last week.
I'm
going to be bereft.
Oh.
What will she do?
I don't know because I don't have another intern like that yet. So I'm not sure.
What will you do?
What will I do? I don't know.
Well.
So if anybody's listening and
don't do that.
and their kids are in college and like politics. And lobbying,
Oh dear.
The cold call that
right.
Works
you all
on
know
that,
what my politics are, so
There you go.
Right.
Well, good morning, all. It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much for being a part of the program, as always. We go to. There's a lot of interesting stories in the news, and it's hard to know exactly where to start. But I think I'm going to go with the. With the documents case and the appeal, not a big surprise here that this case was appealed as it was promised for a while. But the special counsel Jack Smith argued that Judge Aileen Cannon had erred in throwing out charges against Donald Trump of improperly holding national security secrets after leaving office. Federal prosecutors began their bid to resurrect the classified documents case after former President Donald Trump on Monday telling an appeals court in Atlanta that the trial judge had improperly thrown out the charges. In a filing to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, the prosecutors argued that the judge, Aileen Cannon, erred last month when she handed down a bombshell ruling that dismissed the case on the grounds that Jack Smith, the special counsel who brought it, had been appointed to his job illegally. The ruling by Judge Cannon, who was placed on the bench by Mr. Trump, stunned many legal experts for the way that it upended 25 years of Justice Department practice and flew in the face of previous court decisions about the appointments of special prosecutors reaching back to the Watergate era. Issued on the first day of the Republican National Convention, where Mr. Trump formally accepted his party's presidential nomination, I believe it was the first Monday after the assassination attempt.
Yes, it was.
On the day, the first day of the convention, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Judge Cannon's ruling also gave him a major legal victory at an auspicious political moment. Mr. Smith's appellate brief on Monday was merely the start of a legal battle that may end up at the Supreme Court and is likely to drag on until well after the election in November. Should Mr. Trump win the election, he would have the power to fire Mr. Smith and could order the Justice Department to drop the appeal. Should he lose, the appeals process will determine whether he can still go to trial on those charges. That summation from the New York Times. Louis Post.
Look, this woman was appointed by him. I think that this was a political hatchet job of a judicial decision. You know, all of a sudden, special prosecutors aren't okay, where we've relied on them from, you know, going all the way back. I mean, I remember Archibald Cox and Nixon and
then, Leon Jaworski.
Right, right. Yeah. There's been plenty of them. Whoever it was that was this.
Points to Gryffindor, yeah. Mike.
Right. I can't remember who Bill Clinton's was. I mean, I can see him, but I can't remember his name.
Ken Starr?
Yeah, Ken Starr. I mean, yeah. Come on. This was a political favor to the guy who put her in her judgeship. Plain and simple. There's nothing in her decision that can be backed up by law or precedent. And the Supreme Court will have to, if it gets there, will have to reverse itself on so many prior decisions that, it would be a hackneyed version of what our Constitution is. And also a political hack job because Trump put a lot of them there, too.
Mike?
Yeah, I mean, the 11th Circuit, where they're appealing it to, has already one time admonished Judge Cannon in this case when it said that a special master did not need to be appointed to look at which documents were extremely classified and whether they can be entered into court and all that. That was a delay tactic by Judge Cannon. This is a delay tactic by Judge Cannon. I'm confident, even though that court has 7 Republicans and 6 Democrats, it seems to be making judicial decisions based on law. And they'll probably get through the 11th Circuit, and it would go to the Supreme Court. But it doesn't need to because she got the delay that Trump needed. It's not going to happen before the election. It's not going to be affected by the election. And the irony here, this is probably the most straightforward of all the cases against Trump. I mean, you know, we got the pictures of the piles in the bathroom. We got the witnesses. Right. We got the tapes of him directing people. You know, we have him.
Piles of paper.
And the thing is that the Harris campaign will still
the piles
be able
of
to use
documents.
That.
The piles of documents in the new, in the bathroom.
Right. But they'll still be able to use all of this in campaign commercials. But I wonder if anybody can subpoena the phone records of the judge and Trump to see if there were conversations.
Well, I mean, anything like that, like an attempt to impeach the judge or have her thrown off the case based on what you're describing, yeah, it's all possible, but it would need a lot of time. And as this article in the New York Times points out, if Trump is elected to a new term, he'll have the authority to order the Justice Department just to drop it. And that's probably what would happen. So either it's going to happen to citizen Trump a year or more from now, or it's not going to happen at all.
Right.
But call me cynical, Fred. It just seems that at this point, this judge has already done her job in the sense of to hold this case till after the election.
Joe, to be honest with you, I'm not inclined to go there.
Okay.
With our judicial system, I realize that I'll really go out on a ledge and say that Judge Cannon's decision is very controversial. I suspect it's going to be overturned in the Court of Appeals. But the decision itself is backed by a very, very, very long argument that appears to be well researched. I have no idea where the actual merits are here. I'm less inclined to see the 25 year. Rolling back 25 years of decisions as being decisive here. I mean, look, in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education undid 60 years of separate but equal in our education system that had been established in the 1890s in the Plessy v. Ferguson decision. So, you know, I suspect the decision is going to be overturned. But it appears to me that the judge did a fairly serious job in trying to buttress her judicial opinion here.
Not that I'm looking for validation any more than usual, but does anyone disagree with that as far as that the judge did in this case of you put it off till after the election?
Well, I think she did it to put it off until after the election.
Yeah.
Whether it was thorough or not, I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV and I didn't read what she wrote. But to me, from a political point of view, this is just a political hack job.
But often a judge who takes a controversial case and makes a decision like this, embraces one side or the other and their argument and their rhetoric. She embraced that one mm-hmm. side. It's not like she brilliantly went and researched it. I don't think she's demonstrated the capacity for that. That's my personal opinion. She embraced the arguments that were set forth by Trump. And he had good lawyers who researched it. And you can rationalize it by interpreting the Constitution about how someone cannot be, has to be appointed in a certain way, and therefore the attorney general doesn't have the right to appoint a special prosecutor, yet that also has been upheld many times. It's not unlike, you talk about Brown versus the Board of Education, an undid 60 years of bad law. Well, you had the case 2 years ago that undid Roe versus Wade.
Sure.
And that was 50
mm-hmm.
years old. I mean,
right.
You know,
sure.
you make a good point. I mean, the fact that this gets through the 11th Circuit and they maybe overturn Judge Cannon, if it goes to the Supreme Court, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not in a position. I'm a little bit reluctant to try to divine Judge Cannon's motives in here, in this case. Was it a political hit job? Does she truly believe in the soundness of the legal argument she makes? I suspect even in the Court of Appeals there will be a handful of judges, who knows, maybe even a majority that upholds her reasoning.
I just don't know
what I'm sensitive to is a general wave of attacks from right and left in this country on the legitimacy of our political system. Now, Libby, you may be entirely correct about the judge's motives in here, but please understand my inclination to push back a little on that because I think that preserving and upholding our institutions is more important than anything else, and I wish Mr. Trump agreed with me on that because his attack on the 2020 elections, his previous role in the birther controversy, these are attacks on the legitimacy of the American political system. And in our judicial system, I mean, this is just the nature of the judiciary in a democracy. You win some and you lose some.
All right. With those sage words, we go to a break. I want to remind you that you can be a part of the conversation. All you have to do is write to us. Panel@WAMC.org is the email address. Panel@WAMC.org. And we would love to hear from you. And we will get to letters in not too long from now. We're going to take a break. And then we're going to get news from the BBC, and then we'll return with our panel after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Fred Hoff, Libby Post, Mike Spain, Emma Edwards, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome your letters. We also, I want to just mention that the breaking news that just came out just a few moments ago is that Israeli forces have rescued a hostage from Gaza. Israel said that it had freed a 52-year-old man, the eighth hostage to be rescued alive in a military operation after being abducted alongside roughly 250 others. And this is, of course, after what happened 10 months ago, the attacks on October 7th during an operation in the southern Gaza Strip. The Israeli military said on Tuesday that more than 10 months after he was abducted alongside roughly 250 others, the man has been identified, 52 years old, a member of the country's Bedouin Arab minority and the first Israeli Arab hostage to be rescued alive. It said he had been freed by Israeli soldiers and special forces during a, quote, complex operation in southern Gaza, but that it would not disclose further details for security reasons and for the safety of the remaining hostages. Given what is happening in that part of the world, Fred Hoff, what do we make of this news?
Well, it's unadulterated good news. The anytime a hostage can be freed, it's good news. In this case, as you mentioned, Joe, it happens to be an Arab Bedouin. I believe he's 52 years old, and early reports suggest that he's in pretty good physical shape, considering what he's been through. I understand he had been serving as a security guard at one of the kibbutzes that was overrun by Hamas last October 7th.
And this comes as there's been increased fighting on the border. There has been efforts, of course, by the U.S. government, Anthony Blinken, and ceasefire and discussions. We're in sort of a lull at the moment, and I guess, not to be too cliched here, but you can't, you know, be lulled into a false sense of security.
No, not at all. And these discussions about a potential ceasefire are incredibly difficult. It's a classic devil in the details situation. And the decision over the weekend by Hezbollah to try to exact revenge on Israel for the killing of the number two guy in the organization seems to have set back things a little bit. But the essential problem with these negotiations, in my opinion, is that the United States and its Western allies want success more than the parties themselves. Both for the leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, and for the leader of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, there are political reasons to avoid coming to closure. And of course, from the point of view of Iran, the more Palestinians killed in the Gaza Strip, the better, because it contributes to Israel's isolation, and it contributes to a big foreign policy setback for the United States.
We had recently the release of, I think, seven hostages who were all deceased. They were turned over. And is it impossible to ascertain from that or even to understand of the what, 200 remaining of how many would be alive, how many would be, I mean, you have no way of knowing.
No, absolutely no way of knowing. And, you know, I mean, the only thing we can say for sure is that trying to locate the hostages and determining their status are major priorities for the U.S. intelligence community and for the Israeli intelligence community. And, you know, there will be ongoing efforts to rescue hostages. I think in the best of all worlds, however, there would be a ceasefire that would be sustained, that would get many, if not most, or even all of the hostages out, and put an end to the cataclysmic human suffering that's taking place in the Gaza Strip.
I want to hear from the other panelists, but let me just read this paragraph from the New York Times about what I was mentioning over the weekend of the fighting. Hezbollah and Israel appeared to de-escalate following a major confrontation over the weekend, tempering fears of a wider conflict in the Middle East. But for people across the region, any feelings of relief were undercut by a deeper sense of deadlock. And that's sort of where we've been, right? Deadlock?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I would, as you know, as someone who's studied Israel and Lebanon and the problems between them over the decades, I would love to live long enough to read a reliable memoir concerning what actually happened over this past weekend. There have been cryptic references in the press to communication between Israel and Hezbollah through, quote, intermediaries, unquote. It appears that there were elements of this confrontation, this exchange of live fire, which is, you know, which is incredibly dangerous under any circumstances. But it appears that elements of it seem to have been almost rehearsed and prearranged, so as to avoid an all-out war that neither side wants.
Libby?
Yeah, it did seem that way. It didn't seem, because, you know, Israel's not one to back down, and Hezbollah's not one to back down, but it could very well be Iran saying, we're not ready for a full World War III yet, because we know that they support both Hamas and Hezbollah. And also, look, everyone has seen, right or wrong, and it's been mostly wrong, what Israel has done in Gaza, right? I don't think Hezbollah wants that to happen in where they are, nor does Lebanon want that to happen in that country either. Not that they're friendly to Israel at all anymore, but they see the resolve and the fighter power and the one trick pony. We're going to just drive you out. We're going to find the leaders of Hezbollah, Hamas, regardless of the human cost, which isn't the way to go. But both of these organizations use civilians as human shields. I mean, it's like, it's you can't win for losing. No. And you can't lose for winning, right? And so I just think it was well choreographed, and neither side wanted to escalate things. Because, look, you know, if Israel starts the war like they have with Hamas, with Hezbollah, there will be more unrest in the United States. There will be more pressure for the United States to not support Israel. You know, on one hand, that pressure helps Trump, because it's the Biden administration, and she said it last week, Kamala Harris, that she will defend Israel's right to exist and make sure that they have the armaments to defend themselves. But it can also help Trump. And while I think Netanyahu would like that to happen, I think the world in itself would like that not to happen.
Mike Spain?
Yeah, no, that I think the latter part, Libby, you kind of addressed it, and that is you know, from a purely selfish American perspective, this does have impact on the presidential election. I guess listening to your explanation, Fred, which you, I learned so much just from listening to you and reading what you've written about it. Are you optimistic at all that this current phase of negotiations that's going on has a chance to achieve anything, or is it just that Iran is digging in and then Netanyahu has all the reasons that you've many times described, the political reasons not to come up with some kind of a settlement here, because it could mean compromising his own power in Israel if he doesn't. Now he has this as a tool. I mean, is there any? Do you have any optimism?
Yeah. I do have a bit. And as I've mentioned previously on this program, what the United States has done is deployed to this problem the very best we have in the way of diplomatic talent.
Right.
Bill Burns, the director of the CIA, in my opinion, the likely Secretary of State, if Vice President Harris wins this election, is simply the best in the business. And as we discussed last time, I think you looked it up, the Secretary of State has made 9 trips to the region, mostly focused on this problem. So when you look at the sheer effort being made by the United States, you know, there is a reason to have a grain of optimism. But always bear in mind, it's the classic problem we've had in this part of the world. Quite often, particularly on matters of trying to arrange peace, we want things much more than the parties involved.
Yeah.
Right.
And trying to get past that is tough.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, and we'll move on to other topics as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A quick programming note coming up at 11 o'clock today, in our 11 o'clock hour, just a little bit after 11. We will welcome live on the air David Rode, who is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner. His new book is Where Tyranny Begins, The Justice Department, the FBI, and the War on Democracy. And he is the book is out today, and he will be with us to talk about his experiences. He is a foreign correspondent, investigative reporter, covered the wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bosnia, and a former hostage that was actually released, and as a journalist. While covering Afghanistan. So I just wanted to put that on your to-do list, and we'll be having a conversation with David Rode coming up at about 11:10. Also, we have a couple of letters. I want to get to those if we can. And we go to Kathleen. I'm not going to say this is going back to the Aileen Cannon and the filing of the appeal. I'm not going to say that Judge Aileen Cannon is not smart, like some people have, but she is an experience. Surely she has been colluding with Clarence Thomas and the Federalist Society. She was fed her lines. If there was collusion, is that illegal? Judge Cannon is not a serious person. She is a hack. So this is what you were talking before about weaponizing these people of...
Yeah, I mean, I recognize that the listener has a strong opinion here, and the listener may actually have some facts and insight backing up that opinion. And all I can say is that I guess I don't have the same level of fact and insight.
Well, one thing to remember about Judge Cannon, she was appointed by Trump. Where did Trump get his list of people to appoint a federal judgeships.
Libby. I know. The Libby Heritage Foundation.
For $200.
For the Heritage Foundation, the same people behind Project 2025.
Probably. I mean, but certainly conservatives who want to shift the needle on the federal judiciary are providing their nominees. And when a Democrat's elected president, the list comes from more liberal groups. I mean, you know, presidents, when they make appointments, rely on the groups that supported them and that they support politically to come up with candidates for these vacancies. And that's how things change over time. And it's not unusual that he would have picked someone like Judge Cannon, who clearly had demonstrated her political interpretations or her interpretations of the Constitution in a way favorable to those supporting Trump.
Yeah, this is the way it works. And ideally, at the appeal level, all the way up to the Supreme Court, the focus will be on the quality or lack thereof Judge Cannon's decision and the documentation she's provided to back it up. And, you know, I would be content with any outcome. I'm just reluctant to ascribe to the judge in this case, base political motives, designed to affect the November election.
So let me get base for a second, just for a second. So I know we have people who are in our audience right now who are saying, okay, I understand the goings back and forth and got it. But the documents, however they were obtained, they show up at Mar-a-Lago. They're shoved in a ballroom and in a bathroom. And do you have them? Yeah. No, I don't. Do you have them? No, I don't. Do you have them? No, I don't. We're going to come to your house. Do you have them? No, I don't. Oh, what are these?
Oh, I guess I have
look,
them.
I have them.
They're mine.
They're mine. Right. I own them. They're mine. I was president. My stuff. Get away. I understand that the process, the due process, but also there is this, well, okay, but what do we do? What do we do about part of it?
Okay, let's say that the courts ultimately back Judge Cannon's decision. Maybe in the appeals court it goes one way, but it gets to the Supremes and they restore it and say that Jack Smith is not a properly appointed prosecutor, and therefore it's all null. The evidence is still there. The Justice Department, if Trump were not to be elected to another term, the Justice Department would have a compelling case. They could assign it to the U.S. attorney in southern Florida, and he could prosecute it. They could take it many different directions. The evidence is there. He could face the charges. It's just going to take an awful long time.
Yeah, and the irony here is the whole idea behind having special prosecutors has been to insulate the serving administration and the serving attorney general from charges of political bias. Okay, and so now the attorney general Merrick Garland has the option, if he wishes to exercise it, of saying okay, I will take direct control of this prosecution, assign it to a U.S. attorney somewhere, and we can avoid this constitutional question entirely. But then you have former President Trump and his attorney saying, "See, we told you so. The Justice Department is being weaponized against us."
But the other part of this is if the Supreme Court throws it out and says, "Oh yeah, she's right," what does that do to all the work and all the consequences of all the former special prosecutors? Does that get
well? It's set law. I mean, where there's been decisions, those. Well, that's a good question.
You know, I mean,
could somebody appeal their conviction if they were brought to justice by a special prosecutor.
It's like, you know, the tainted, the DA any of the, who any does of the a bad
living
job
Watergate and, criminals, right. Can they go to you know, court and look for...
right. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton. I mean, there's a lot of them.
I know. Well, I mean, that happens every time there's a big decision.
But remember a million years ago... 3 months ago,
yes.
Where we on this program were saying, okay, these are all of the cases that Trump is facing. And the one that seemed to be the one that had the legs was the documents case. Mm-hmm. And now not so much, right?
Well, it's a
Not right away.
It's a narrow, it's a narrow question. Of who is entitled constitutionally to conduct this prosecution? Okay, Judge Cannon's opinion, as I understand it, and I've heard it's a couple of hundred pages or something, does not allude at all to the merits of the case. Doesn't comment at all right. on the merits. It is focused sharply on the question of. Of whether somebody appointed by the Attorney General as a special prosecutor has the constitutional standing to conduct the prosecution,
and we can't walk and chew gum at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm. I guess not.
Yeah.
So this has to be resolved. It's not going to be resolved before November, and if Trump is not elected to another term, it'll. Still probably play out over a long period of time.
All right. Go ahead. Oh, anybody else?
No?
All right, fine. We have a minute. Anybody else? No? Mm-hmm. All right, we start a new topic, but all right. No, I'll go to letters. They'll do that. That's a good I mean, it's all quality stuff, but in some cases we may call this filler. But here we go. Ambassador Hoff appears to be missing one point in his even-handed discussion of Judge Cannon's ruling. This was not one isolated incident, but just the latest in a string of apparently biased rulings in favor of former President Trump.
Well, I admit they appear to be biased. Maybe they are not, but they appear to be. It certainly looks that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm aware of the fact that Justice Cannon's previous rulings on this case have been very much welcomed by the former president and his attorneys. I'm not unaware of that.
Let us not walk the road of conspiracy theories. I was about to preach there for a moment. Let us not walk the road of conspiracy theories, despite the fact that the choice of Aileen Cannon for the position was well thought out, and the appointment of Cannon to this case smells pretty bad. From all I have read, she is just plain incompetent. And this from TU says, I write to object to the panel's approach to Cannon's decision as business as usual. Any honest legal scholar who has read the decision is appalled at how clearly the fix was in. Have any of you read this decision? I have, and it is atrocious. That from East Chatham. We'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with more fun and frivolity with our group. We welcome you. The fun and frivolity is on you, Fred. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday. It's the 27th of August, and a delight to have you all here listening to the House of Hamel playing the Parlor Room in Northampton, Massachusetts on Friday night, the 6th of September. And you can find out more information by going to parlorroom.org. And you can see our playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. Diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff is here. Libby Post, political consultant and lobbyist. And former Times Union associate editor Mike Spain. Emma Edwards, also in the House, senior at Wellesley. And Libby's wonderful intern is here with us as well. We welcome you again, panel, at WAMC.org. Let us go to some other stories that are making news and some things that I think are of interest. One is, of course, the assassination task force that is looking into the assassination attempt on the life of former President Trump in July of this year. This task force visited Butler, Pennsylvania yesterday, and it is a bipartisan task force, and they are looking in to the shooting that took place where a 20-year-old Thomas Crooks opened fire at a campaign rally. And this is on the grounds of the Butler Farm Show. So what they're all trying to find out is how this happened and look into the steps that allowed this young man to open fire at a campaign rally at a building at a level that was so close to where the president was speaking. Now, as this bipartisan commission, as bipartisan task force, investigates the assassination attempt, some hard right Republicans are already warning of a cover-up. As the Republicans and Democrats said they were pushing ahead on their bipartisan investigation authorized last month by a unanimous vote of the House, a small but vocal band of right-wing lawmakers who have criticized and circulated conspiracy theories about the shooting said they were conducting their own simultaneous inquiry. So myself and Corey Mills are leading a parallel investigation into what happened on July 13th and the assassination attempt, according to Representative Eli Crane. He did say J13, but I didn't use that because the words wouldn't come out of my mouth.
So military.
Yes, exactly. said last week on the War Room podcast, referring to the July 13th shooting, and we're doing that because, like many of your listeners, we don't trust the federal government to actually do the job necessary. All right, Fred, how do you get over, I mean, there's a lot to talk about here, but how do you get over the that of trusting
how do you say
the
June
federal
13th
government
in jargon,
to actually doing the job necessary? And I guess, you know, even a broader question is, what is the job that is necessary? I mean, find out how it happened. Right?
Find out how it happened. And look, by all reasonable accounts, at least the ones I'm reading, it appears that what we're dealing with here is a case of gross incompetence. And you know, as I used to tell my students at Bard, quite often, please. Never underestimate the role played by incompetence, whether it's in foreign affairs, military affairs, or anything else. There is really no need to grasp for conspiracy theories in all of this. And the problem with conspiracy theories is that they don't add to what I consider to be the most important aspect of all of this, and that is the need for by name accountability. Who, by name, is actually responsible for what happened on July 13th in Butler, Pennsylvania?
And it could have been a group affair, right? I mean,
it could have, but there should be names attached to it. I think one of the one of the saddest developments I've seen in this country in my lifetime is a general tendency to ascribe blame to a system that no longer seems to be working well. If we want to inspire people, particularly people in the Secret Service who have a very very sensitive, very difficult job, but if we want to inspire them to do their absolute best, then by name accountability is needed, in my opinion.
And the reason I said more than one, I mean, if one of the things, and correct me if I have the details wrong, but one of the big questions that's lingering is that there it was known that there was someone out there who was casing the perimeter. It was seen and reported at least twice that this suspect had what they believed to be a firearm. They also believed that one officer actually saw him on the roof. And one of the questions that comes out, which seems to be a very legitimate question to me, is why was the event not held? Why was the event not put on hold until after it was either figured out who this guy was, find this guy, or realize that it wasn't a threat that they thought.
And
it
Joe,
was.
even if this person had not materialized that day, leaving unattended a rooftop with clear line of sight access to the person making the remarks, namely the former president of the United States, just inexcusable. Somebody or a group of people, somebody is responsible for this, and that's what I hope will be revealed by the real investigations going on here.
One thing I would like to point out: this does not seem to be, when I say it's a bipartisan investigation, the two people, Mr. Crane and Mr. Wills, the Republicans who are complaining about this, were upset at Speaker of the House and Republican Mike Johnson, who left them off of the both these gentlemen, by the way, were military snipers, but they were left off of the panel, and it is a decision that Mr. Crane has called political, and then he said indicated that the Congressional Task Force might try to engage in a cover-up. So that, which is interesting, considering that you're talking about both Republicans and Democrats on this particular.
Yeah, and this
task
is
force.
If this is their complaint, they should take it up with the Speaker. They don't need to imply or to say directly that the Biden administration played some kind of deliberate role in the targeting of President Trump.
But then they wouldn't get any press. That's what this is all about, is raising their profiles and raising the idea that this is all a conspiracy and this is all,
yeah, and sad,
you know,
false. And sadly, there's a constituency for this.
Right, of course. Yeah. But, you know, we had Trump and blah, 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 but this was 30 years ago, right? And there was questions about who was going to be. Nobody would have gone to the press like these two did, right? They would have gone to the Speaker. And they would have expressed their dismay. They would have, you know, acted with decorum. They would have some respect for the institution. These folks don't.
Yeah.
It's just that simple. They think everything is a conspiracy theory. They think the deep state really does exist, and that somebody's pulling these strings. They'll end up blaming Biden for all of it. For the and Harris, they'll somehow try to make a line between the shooting and that Harris was behind it. And you know, it's just they will do whatever they need to do or whatever they think they need to do to stay in power and relevant.
This from the New York Times: since the July 13th shooting, the Secret Service has admitted security failures. They have assigned 5 agents to administrative duty as a result of an internal investigation. And the director of the Secret Service at the time, Kimberly Cheadle, resigned after the shooting amid bipartisan calls for her to step down. But, Fred, and I know this is perhaps obvious, but that's much different than holding people directly accountable for what happened.
Yeah, the the resignation of the director of the Secret Service was an excellent move, especially after her testimony in Congress, which I must say was the worst I have ever seen. In my professional lifetime, I've testified in front of both the Senate and the House, and I've been a witness to a great many testimonies. I have never, ever, ever seen anything that that abysmal. And I would even include Colonel Ali North's testimony back in the days of Iran-Contra. I mean, this was really bad.
Nice call.
And I suspect, you know, I think it's probably pretty obvious that the five agents placed on administrative duty are the ones where there is real focus on what was done that day on July 13th to provide the requisite amount of security.
One line that struck me, and I didn't know this, but maybe I just it was a busy news cycle at that time, and perhaps it got away from me. But one of the House members said that being here and seeing the proximity of the buildings, it reminds me, quite frankly, how outrageous it was that the former director of the Secret Service did not come here to get a sense of what this looked like.
Right.
Adding, we were inches away from an American catastrophe. That is shocking.
Yeah. Yeah. She never should have been in that position. I have no doubt that in her overall career with the Secret Service, she provided good value. But this is probably a classic example of someone being promoted over the level of competence.
Peter Principle.
The Peter Principle. Thank you.
And she's a woman, so it just makes it even more difficult for another woman to ever ascend to be the head of the Secret Service.
You know, and that would be really, really, really unfortunate if that turns out to be the case.
Fred, we'll move on to other topics. I just want one more moment on this, though, and that is the importance of the members who were there, the members of this task force who went to Butler yesterday and walked the grounds, were on the roof, went from one building to another. Just talk a little bit about the importance of that, of seeing the space, different from reading a report, different than seeing the pictures, different than watching the video, different than seeing the drone footage that has been available. And walking from one spot to another so you can figure it out as to where someone was at any given time.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, there's going to be a report. And the credibility of that report will rest to some degree, perhaps to a large degree, on what the authors of the report actually did. Were they on the spot? Did they walk the grounds? Did they examine the various line of sight factors in all of this? I'd say that's quite aside from gathering facts objectively, which requires that one be on the ground. The credibility of the ultimate product rests on this.
There was also the question of whether there was the person, whether Crooks acted alone in this. There's no indication that he didn't. But I don't know how you, in the end, ultimately rule that out.
Yeah, I don't know how you prove a negative in this case, but you know, all indications seem to suggest on this point that it was he very much acted on his own.
Emma.
Yeah. I think that it doesn't matter if he acted on his own, because any attempt to look at this and place all of the blame on Crooks or place all of the blame on the Secret Service for allowing it to happen, which it is mainly their fault for allowing that to, it is complete oversight. Like, I don't think anyone's arguing against that. But to look at it and say that it needs to be a completely bipartisan task force because it's a conspiracy from inside Democrats is a attempt of the Republicans to look at the gun violence epidemic that they've created and the political violence that they've allowed to fester in our society, the MAGA party has allowed to fester, and look at that epidemic that, as a young person, I grew up with and feel very strongly about, like, that gun violence is rampant, this political violence is rampant. And to look at that and to say that it's someone else's fault is exactly what they're looking to do. And it is one of the biggest problems. It's Crooks' fault that this happened, but it's also the oversight of the Secret Service. It's their failing, but it is also the failing of Trump, and it is also the failing of the Republican Party, because this is not the first time that someone has been shot. It's the first time that Trump has been shot. But this kind of political violence happens every single day.
I want to, we have a letter. indeed. We have a letter from Mike, not our Mike. And if it is, nice going.
Read the letter first.
Yeah, it takes Fred to task, but I, so.
No, that's not me.
It is profoundly disappointing to hear Ambassador Hoff advocate for disregarding the understanding of systems in our political discourse and education. Systemic awareness and understanding is fundamental to mass political activity, perhaps one reason why so many Americans have almost no faith in American institutions, which are systems, are they not? Is because these institutions have been demonstrably broken, degraded, and dysfunctional. To suggest that we should focus our attention on individual actors within those systems is borderline anti-political.
Well, you know, I think we've been able to see for quite some time what life is like without accountability. I mean, I agree there are all kinds of institutional issues affecting the Secret Service, budgeting, the sheer size of the problem, you know, particularly during a presidential campaign, and routinely securing the safety of the President of the United States and his family. But I think I think it's very regrettable that we sweep personal accountability under the rug and just say, oh, it's the system. The system isn't working, so you know, have a nice day.
All right. Let's see. A couple of cases. I'm trying to put letters into context, and I'm sorry if I'm having difficulty doing that. This is from Jeremy, who says, Joe, is not a Georgia case of the recorded phone call saying just find me 11,780 votes not a slam dunk? I think I was indicating that out of
all the federal cases,
yeah, that the,
by Jack Smith, yeah,
that this was the one that seemed to be the. That I said that the documents case seemed to be the strongest.
And yet, the case in Georgia is at a standstill, and it doesn't look like it's going to move forward anytime soon.
Right. There is that. Also, we go to this letter, and I may not. Let's see. With regards to Israel, you keep saying the U.S. is more committed to a ceasefire than Israel and Hamas. You make the point that we are sending our best diplomats and that Anthony Blinken has been there 9 times. So what? What is happening is genocide. The U.S. must stop sending bombs and weapons immediately.
You know, whenever I hear somebody use that word, genocide, two things come to mind. Either the person using the word doesn't know what genocide is, or the person using the word is an anti-Semite, or a third possibility is both. The way Israel has waged war in the Gaza Strip is in my view wrong, counterproductive, unnecessarily destructive. And I would not be at all surprised to learn that that war crimes have been committed. But the use of the word genocide in this case is absolutely improper.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and actually wrap up the panel portion of our program. We welcome you to join us in the remaining moments. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we'll move on to other topics as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Fred Hoff, Libby Post, Mike Spain, Emma Edwards, and your questions and comments after this short break in the BBC. A Tuesday morning roundtable panel that includes Fred Hoff, Libby Post, Mike Spain, Emma Edwards, and you. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to get in and make a comment or ask a question of the group. Panel at WAMC.org. Recently on the campaign trail, this from the New York Times, Donald Trump has talked up his aggressive stance on China, positioning himself as a tough negotiator in a brutal trade war. But a new memoir by Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, one of Trump's national security advisors, throws that narrative and many other stories that Trump tells about his time in office into stark relief. As McMaster writes in At War With Ourselves, the president could sometimes be kept on the straight and narrow with a clever dose of reverse psychology. Xi Jinping wants you to say this. Xi Jinping wants you to say that. But just as often, McMaster shows Trump to have been an unpredictable waffler who undermined himself to the advantage of his competitors on the world stage. In November 2017, President Trump visited China on the third leg of a 13-day trip around Asia. It was his most consequential destination, McMaster explains. As they flew to Beijing, he warned Trump that Xi would try to trick him into saying something that was good for China but bad for the U.S. and its allies. The CCP's favorite phrase, win-win, he recalls telling his boss at one point, actually meant that China won twice. Trump seemed to hear him, but in the great hall of the people, the president strayed from his talking points. He agreed with Xi that military exercises in South Korea were provocative and a waste of money, and suggested that China might have a legitimate claim to Japan's Senkaku Islands. McMaster, his stomach sinking, passed a note to General John Kelly, the chief of staff. Xi just ate our lunch, it read. At War With Ourselves is intended to be a companion to Battlegrounds, McMaster's 2020 assessment of UN foreign policy backsliding since the Cold War, but it works well as a standalone and serves as essential reading for anyone looking at considering a potential second round of Trump as a global leader. I want to just link this to yet another story, too, and that is that as the candidates go around and do their candidate thing, about an article in the Washington Post this morning about how Trump and Harris are jockeying for advantage on military strength. And neither candidate served in the military, but both have wrapped themselves in its rituals and questioned the other's competence on the issues. President Trump sought to tie Vice President Kamala Harris to the U.S.'s deadly withdrawal from Afghanistan yesterday, accusing her and President Biden of overseeing the most embarrassing day in the history of our country. His quote, this done at an event at Arlington National Cemetery.
Well, I think McMaster's book also plays into the other article from the Times about how many Republican aides from Bush and Mitt Romney and others are saying, support Harris, don't vote for Trump. And
you know,
I think
you're right, Libby, but it's only 200.
Only 200. I'm waiting for President Bush to endorse Kamala Harris, and I think it may come.
Didn't Democrats wait for that last time?
But I think it's going to come this time, because now they've seen what another Trump presidency, they know what another Trump presidency will mean.
But even if he does, if George W. Bush comes out and endorses Trump, I mean, the Republicans will just attack him and they'll you know, I mean, he's sort of an outsider. He's a previous guy.
But
Trumpism has taken over the Republican Party. The Republican Party now is the Trump Party.
There are disaffected Republicans who need to hear from the people they consider to be their leadership, George W. Bush, Mitt Romney, and to give them permission, like Adam Kunzinger did the other night and Ray Cooper. Mm-hmm. It gives them permission to vote on the Democratic line. And so because they're being patriotic, they're not voting Democrat or Republican per se, but they're voting for the health and welfare of the country. And, you know, in terms of who's got more, you know, is it Corporal Bonespur or, you know, the vice president? Who knows? I think the vice president probably has a better understanding of the military and a better understanding of military operations because she's actually been with Biden and doing stuff. Afghanistan was not a great way of ending that 20-year war. I'll give anybody that. But, you know, to say that everybody always jockeys who's going to be the best military leader, you know, that's what you have the Joint Chiefs for. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but, you know, there's very few presidents, especially of this era, after World War II and all those vets are gone, who have served in the military. And President Bonesburg, you know, got deferred for Vietnam. And he doesn't really, I know he doesn't know what he's doing. And McMaster's is clear about that. John Kelly was clear about that. So they'll try to out-jockey each other. That's what they always do. But, you know, we'll see what happens. But I think Romney, Bush, the other mainstream Republicans, if they start coming out for Harris, it will have a good impact.
Fred. Yeah, and I agree with you. The Joint Chiefs are very important. The service chiefs are very important. But we only have one commander in chief.
Right.
We have one final decider, as George W. Bush would have put it, and it's important that person have the requisite knowledge, leadership skills, et cetera, et cetera. I would note that in today's New York Times there is a very, very interesting and positive review of H.R. McMaster's new book, At War with Ourselves. And Joe, I hope you can. I hope you'll be able to get Lieutenant General McMaster to speak with you about the new book. The best thing I read weekly is the review section of the weekend Wall Street Journal. I mean, it is just one outstanding article and book review after another. And in this weekend's, this past weekend's review section, there's an excellent piece by Lieutenant General McMaster that paints a really alarming picture of President Trump's vulnerability to flattery and manipulation. Mm. In this particular article, focusing on Russia's Vladimir Putin. On the Republicans, the 200 Republicans who have signed this letter, I noted that some of the most prominent were people who served Senator John McCain, a person I got to know during the last, I don't know, 5 or 7 years of Senator McCain's life. Back in, back in 2016, when candidate Donald Trump made the remark, I don't particularly think that what John McCain did was very special. I don't like people who get captured.
Right. Okay.
I thought at the time, this is it for his candidacy. Who with any degree of patriotism at all you know, could vote for this. I mean, John McCain, who was, you know, shot down. He was a naval aviator, shot down, imprisoned in the Hanoi Hilton, was the son of the chief of naval operations at the time. And arrangements had been made to return John McCain to the United States. He refused. He refused to abandon his fellow prisoners. He spent another 3 years being routinely tortured because of that decision. And Donald Trump thinks this is not an American hero?
What
an outrage.
Trump would have left in a heartbeat if he was in that position.
Isn't it Corey Lewandowski, who's now back at the campaign? Mm-hmm. Wasn't he the one who kind of came up with the swift vote campaign when John Kerry was running?
I think John Kerry
was awarded three Purple Hearts in Vietnam, and they somehow turned him into a coward.
Yeah.
And at the time, I mean, it just shows you that if you hammer away, I mean, they're doing it to Tim Walz now.
It's not getting much traction, though.
Yeah.
It really
isn't. I mean, it's just hammer away at some minor little thing in someone's resume that may or may not be even accurate, and cast doubt when you have, you know, as you call him, Corporal Bonespur.
Right.
President Bonespur.
President Bonespur.
And I think it's good that we have two vice presidential candidates who are veterans.
Yeah.
But what I would like to see is the respective campaigns knock it off with the attacks. And both of these candidates focus on trying to interest able-bodied young Americans in military service instead of, you know, one side saying, oh, he was just a public affairs person, and the other side saying, oh, he never went overseas, he was never in combat. Knock it off. You both served honorably. Let's try a higher purpose here.
All right, we're going to end it there. My thanks to everyone for being a part of the program this morning. Another fine effort by all parties. I thank you all so much. My thanks to the listeners. My thanks to Mike Spain, Fred Hoff, Emma Edwards, and Libby Post. Thank you so much for being with us. Great to have you all here. We'll be back. We have a very special interview right after this.